Question is, how can you find enough of this solitude in the hyper-connected 21st century? To answer it, we can draw an unexpected insight from Thoreau's cabin at Walden Pond. Thoreau's retreat to the woods beyond Concord, Massachusetts, with the intention to live more deliberately, is cited as a classic example of solitude. Thoreau helped spread this conception. His book about the experience, Walden, is rich with long passages describing Thoreau alone and observing the slow rhythms of nature. You'll never think of pond ice the same way again after you read Thoreau's lengthy discussion of how its qualities change throughout the winter. In the decades since Walden's release, however, critics have been busy attacking the mythology of Walden as an isolated outpost. Historian W. Barksdale Maynard, to cite one example among many, listed in a 2005 essay the many ways in which Thoreau was anything but isolated during his time at the pond. Thoreau's cabin, it turns out, was not in the woods, but in a clearing near the woods that was in sight of a well-traveled public road. Thoreau was only a 30-minute walk from his hometown of Concord, where he returned regularly for meals and social calls. Friends and family, for their part, visited him constantly at his cabin, and Walden Pond, far from an untrammeled oasis, was then, as it remains today, a popular destination for tourists seeking a nice walk or swim. But as Maynard explains, this complicated mixture of solitude and companionship is not a secret Thoreau was trying to hide. It was, in some sense, the whole point. Thoreau's intention was not to inhabit a wilderness, he writes, but to find wildness in a suburban setting. We can substitute solitude for wildness in this sentence without changing its meaning. Thoreau had no interest in complete disconnection, as the intellectual milieu of mid-19th century Concord was surprisingly well developed, and Thoreau didn't want to completely disengage from this energy. What Thoreau sought in his experiment at Walden was the ability to move back and forth between a state of solitude and a state of connection. He valued time alone with his thoughts, staring at ice, but he also valued companionship and intellectual stimulation. He would have rejected a life of true hermit-style isolation with the same vigor with which he protested the thoughtless consumerism of the early industrial age. This cycle of solitude and connection is a solution that comes up often when studying people who successfully sidestep solitude deprivation. Think, for example, of Lincoln spending his summer nights at his cottage before returning to the bustling White House in the morning, or of Raymond Kethledge taking a break from the busy courthouse to clarify his thoughts in a quiet barn. The pianist Glenn Gould once proposed a mathematical formula for this cycle, telling a journalist, "I've always had a sort of intuition that for every hour you spend with other human beings, you need X number of hours alone. Now what that X represents, I don't really know, but it's a substantial ratio." It's exactly this alternation between regular time alone with your thoughts and regular connection that I propose as the key to avoiding solitude deprivation in a culture that also demands connection. As Thoreau's example emphasizes, there's nothing wrong with connectivity, but if you don't balance it with regular doses of solitude, its benefits will diminish. To help you realize this cycle in your modern life, this chapter concludes with a small collection of practices, each of which offers a specific and effective approach to integrating more solitude into an otherwise connected routine. These practices are not exhaustive, nor are they obligatory. Think of them instead as a look at the varied ways that people have succeeded in creating their own metaphorical cabin by the pond in an increasingly noisy world. Practice. Leave your phone at home. The Alamo Drafthouse Cinema in Austin, Texas, doesn't allow you to use phones once the film begins. The glow of the screen distracts patrons from the cinematic experience, and the Alamo Drafthouse is the type of place where people respect cinematic experience. Most movie theaters, of course, politely ask moviegoers to put away their phones, but this particular venue takes this prohibition seriously. Here's their official policy, lifted from their website. We have zero tolerance for talking or cell phone use of any kind during films. We'll kick you out. Promise. We've got backup. This policy is notable in part because it's so exceptional in the movie business. The standard multiplex has implicitly given up on the idea that people can make it through a film without using their phone. Some are even considering formalizing this retreat. You can't tell a 22-year-old to turn off their cell phone, said the CEO of the AMC theater chain in a 2016 interview with Variety. That's not how they live their life. He then revealed that the company is considering relaxing their existing, though largely ignored, cell phone bans. The failed fight against cell phones in movie theaters is a specific consequence of a more general shift that's occurred over the past decade, the transformation of the cell phone from an occasionally useful tool to something we can never be apart from. This rise of cell phone as vital appendage is supported by many different explanations. Young people, for example, worry that even temporary disconnection might lead them to miss out on something better they could be doing. Parents worry that their kids won't be able to reach them in an emergency. Travelers need directions and recommendations for places to eat. Workers fear the idea of being both needed and unreachable. And everyone secretly fears being bored. What's remarkable about these concerns is how recently we started really caring about them. People born before the mid-1980s have strong memories of life without cell phones. All of the concerns listed previously still existed in theory, but no one worried much about them. Before I had my driver's license, for example, if I needed someone to pick me up from school after sports practice, I'd use a payphone. Sometimes my parents were home, and sometimes I had to leave a message and hope they got it. Getting lost and asking for directions was just a regular part of driving in a new city, and not really a big deal. Learning to read maps was one of the first things I did after learning to drive. Parents were comfortable with the idea that when they were out for dinner and a movie, the babysitter had no easy way to reach them in the case of an emergency. I don't mean to create a false sense of nostalgia for these pre-cell phone times. All of the aforementioned scenarios are somewhat improved by better communication tools. But what I do want to emphasize is that most of this improvement is minor. Put another way, in 90% of your daily life, the presence of a cell phone either doesn't matter or makes things only slightly more convenient. They're useful, but it's hyperbolic to believe its ubiquitous presence is vital. This claim can be validated in part by turning to the surprisingly vibrant subculture of people who go extended periods without cellular communication. We know about this group because many of them publish essays describing their experience. If you read enough of these dispatches, a common theme emerges. Life without a cell phone is occasionally annoying, but it's much less debilitating than you might expect. A young woman named Hope King, for example, ended up spending a little over 4 months without a phone after her iPhone was stolen at a clothing store. She could have replaced it right away, but delaying this decision struck her at the time as an act of symbolic defiance against the thief. A perhaps misguided but good-intentioned way of saying, "See, you didn't hurt me." In an article she wrote about her experience, King listed several nuisances of life without a phone, including the need to look up maps in advance before heading to a new destination, and the slightly increased complexity of talking with her family, which she did over Skype on her laptop. She also experienced a small number of major annoyances, such as the time she was stuck in the back of a taxi, running late for a meeting with her boss, desperately hoping to snag a Wi-Fi signal from a nearby Starbucks on her iPad so she could send him a note. But for the most part, the experience was less drastic than she feared. Indeed, as she writes, some things that concerned her about post-cell phone life were surprisingly easy, and when she was finally forced to buy a new phone, a new job required it, she actually felt anxious about the return to constant connection. The purpose of these observations is to underscore the following point. The urgency we feel to always have a phone with us is exaggerated. To live permanently without these devices would be needlessly annoying, but to regularly spend a few hours away from them should give you no pause. It's important that I convince you of this reality, as spending more time away from your phone is exactly what I'm going to ask you to do. I argued earlier in this chapter that smartphones are the primary enabler of solitude deprivation. To avoid this condition, therefore, it makes sense to try to spend regular time away from these devices, recreating the frequent exposure to solitude that until recently was an unavoidable part of daily life. I recommend that you try to spend some time away from your phone most days. This time could take many forms, from a quick morning errand to a full evening out, depending on your comfort level. Succeeding with this strategy requires that you abandon the belief that not having your phone is a crisis. As I just argued, this belief is new and largely invented, but it can still take some practice before you fully accept its truth. If you're struggling at first, a useful compromise is to bring your phone where you're going, but then leave it in your car's glove compartment. This way, if there's an emergency that requires connection, you can always go retrieve your device, but it's not right there with you, where it can destroy solitude at a moment's notice. If you're not driving, but out with someone else, it can work just as well to have them hold your phone for you, assuming you can convince them to do so. As before, you have emergency access, but not easy access. To emphasize what I hope is clear, this practice is not about getting rid of your phone. Most of the time, you'll have your phone with you and enjoy all of its conveniences. It does aim, however, to convince you that it's completely reasonable to live a life in which you sometimes have a phone with you and sometimes do not. Indeed, not only is this lifestyle reasonable, but it represents a small behavior tweak that can reap large benefits by protecting you from the worst effects of solitude deprivation. Practice. Take long walks. In 1889, as Friedrich Nietzsche's fame began to spread, he published a brief introduction to his philosophy. It was called Twilight of the Idols, and it took him only 2 weeks to write. Early in the book is a chapter that contains aphorisms on topics that interested Nietzsche. It's in this chapter, more specifically in Maxim 34, that we find the following strong claim. Only thoughts reached by walking have value. To underscore his esteem for walking, Nietzsche also notes, "The sedentary life is the very sin against the Holy Spirit." Nietzsche was speaking from personal experience. As the French philosopher Frédéric Gros elaborates in his 2009 book on the intersection of walking and philosophy, Nietzsche, by 1889, was concluding a wildly productive decade in which he rebounded from failing health and wrote some of his greatest books. This period began 10 years earlier, when Nietzsche was forced by recurring migraines, among other maladies, to leave his position as a university professor. He submitted his resignation in May 1879, and later that summer found himself in a small village on the upper Engadine slopes. In the decade that stretched between his resignation and the publication of Twilight of the Idols, Nietzsche survived on a series of small grants that provided enough funds for modest lodging and the ability to take the train back and forth between the mountains, where he would escape the summer heat, and the sea, where he would escape the winter cold. It was during this period, when Nietzsche found himself surrounded by some of Europe's most scenic trails, that he became the peerless walker of legend. As Gros recounts, during his first summer on the upper Engadine, Nietzsche began to walk up to 8 hours a day. During these walks, he would think, eventually filling 6 small notebooks with the prose that became The Wanderer and His Shadow, the first of many influential books he wrote during a decade powered by ambulation. Nietzsche, of course, is not the only historical figure to use walking to support a contemplative life. In his book, Gros also points to the example of the French poet Arthur Rimbaud, a restless soul who set off on many long pilgrimages on foot, often short of money but rich in passion, or Jean-Jacques Rousseau, who once wrote, "I never do anything but when walking. The countryside is my study." About Rousseau, Gros adds, "The mere sight of a desk and a chair was enough to make him feel sick." The value of walking also suffuses American culture. Wendell Berry, another proponent of strolling, used long outings through the fields and forests of his rural Kentucky to clarify his pastoral values. As he once wrote, "As I walk, I am always reminded of the slow, patient building of soil in the woods, and I am reminded of the events and companions of my life, for my walks, after so long, are cultural events." Berry was likely inspired by Thoreau, who is arguably America's most strident booster of walking. In his famed Lyceum lecture, which was posthumously published in the Atlantic Monthly under the title of Walking, Thoreau labels this activity a noble art, clarifying, "The walking of which I speak has nothing in it akin to taking exercise, but is itself the enterprise and adventure of the day." These historical walkers embraced the activity for different reasons. Nietzsche regained his health and found an original philosophical voice. Berry formalized his intuitive nostalgia. Thoreau found a connection to nature he thought fundamental to a thriving human life. These different reasons, however, are all served by the same key property of walking. It's a fantastic source of solitude. It's important here to remember our technical definition of solitude as freedom from input from other minds, as it's exactly this absence of reaction to the clatter of civilization that supports all of these benefits. Nietzsche emphasized this point when he contrasted the originality of his walk-stimulated ideas with those produced by the bookish scholar locked in the library, reacting only to other people's work. "We do not belong," he wrote, "to those who have ideas only among books, when stimulated by books." Motivated by these historical lessons, we too should embrace walking as a high-quality source of solitude. In doing so, we should heed Thoreau's warning that we're not talking about a short jaunt for a little exercise, but honest-to-goodness, deep-in-the-woods, Nietzsche-on-the-slope-of-a-mountain-style long journeys. These are the grist of productive aloneness. I've long embraced this philosophy. When I was a postdoc at MIT, my wife and I rented a tiny apartment on Beacon Hill, about a mile's walk across the Longfellow Bridge to the east side of campus where I worked. I made this walk every day, regardless of the weather. I would sometimes meet my wife after work on the banks of the Charles River. If I got there early, I would read. It was on these riverbanks that, appropriately enough, I first discovered the writings of Thoreau and Emerson. Living as I now do in Tacoma Park, Maryland, a small town inside the Washington, D.C. Beltway, I can no longer make long daily walks by a river part of my commute. One of the features that attracted me to this town, however, is its extensive sidewalks shaded by a well-maintained tree canopy. I'm quickly gaining a reputation as that odd professor who seems to be constantly wandering up and down the Tacoma Park streets. I use these walks for multiple purposes. The most common activities include trying to make progress on a professional problem, such as a math proof for my work as a computer scientist, or a chapter outline for a book, and self-reflection on some particular aspect of my life that I think needs more attention. I sometimes go on what I call gratitude walks, where I just enjoy particularly good weather, or take in a neighborhood I like, or, if I'm in the middle of a particularly busy or stressful period, try to generate a sense of anticipation for a better season to come. I sometimes start a walk with the intent of tackling one of these goals, and then soon discover my mind has other ideas about what really needs attention. In such instances, I try to defer to my cognitive inclinations and remind myself how hard it would be to pick up these signals amid the noise that dominates in the absence of solitude. In short, I would be lost without my walks because they've become one of my best sources of solitude. This practice proposes that you'll find similar benefits by spending more time alone on your feet. The details of this practice are simple. On a regular basis, go for long walks, preferably somewhere scenic. Take these walks alone, which means not just by yourself, but also, if possible, without your phone. If you're wearing headphones or monitoring a text message chain or, God forbid, narrating the stroll on Instagram, you're not really walking, and therefore you're not going to experience this practice's greatest benefits. If you cannot abandon your phone for logistical reasons, then put it at the bottom of a backpack so you can use it in an emergency but cannot easily extract it at the first hint of boredom. If you're worried about not having your phone, see the discussion on this topic in the preceding practice. The hardest part of this habit is making the time. In my experience, you'll probably have to invest effort to clear the necessary hours from your schedule. They're unlikely to arise naturally. This might mean, for example, scheduling workday walks on your calendar well in advance. They're a great way to start or end a day. Or negotiating with your family sometimes in the evening or on the weekend when you're going to hit the trail. It also helps if you learn to broaden your definition of good weather. You can walk on cold days, or when it's snowing, or even during light rain. During my MIT commutes, I learned the value of good rain pants. I once even took my dog for a short walk while a hurricane worked its way past Washington, D.C., though in retrospect, this was probably not a smart decision. These efforts are hard, but the rewards are big. I'm quite simply happier and more productive, by noticeably large factors, when I'm walking regularly. Many others, both today and historically, enjoy the same benefits that come from this substantial injection of solitude into an otherwise hectic life. Thoreau once wrote, "I think that I cannot preserve my health and spirits unless I spend 4 hours a day at least, and it is commonly more than that, sauntering through the woods and over the hills and fields, absolutely free from all worldly engagements." Most of us will never meet Thoreau's ambitious commitment to ambulation, but if we remain inspired by his vision and try to spend as much time as is reasonable on foot and engaging in the noble art of walking, we too will experience success in preserving our health and spirits. Practice. Write letters to yourself. I have a stack of 12 black, pocket-size moleskin notebooks on the top shelf of a bookcase in my home office. A 13th notebook is currently in my work bag. Given that I bought my first moleskin in the summer of 2004, and I'm writing these words in the early fall of 2017, this works out to about one notebook per year. My use of these journals has evolved over time. My very first entry was made on August 7, 2004, in the very first moleskin I owned. I bought this notebook at the MIT Co-op bookstore soon after my arrival in Cambridge to start my life as a graduate student. Its first entry is therefore titled, appropriately enough, MIT, and it lists some ideas for research projects. The early entries in this first notebook are mainly focused on professional topics. In addition to graduate student issues, it also includes quite a few notes about marketing my first book, How to Win at College, which was published in early 2005. These entries are interesting today, mainly for their humorously dated cultural references. One such entry solemnly declares, "Take a page from Howard Dean's campaign, empower people." While another, and I swear I'm not making this up, references both Ugg boots and the hit early 2000s reality show, The Osbournes. In early 2007, however, the content of my notebooks broadens from a narrow focus on professional projects to also include reflections and ideas about my life more generally. One entry around this period is titled, "Five Things to Focus on This Semester," while another details some thoughts on blank page productivity, an organizational system I was experimenting with at the time. The fall of 2008 sees a more significant shift toward deeper introspection, with an entry titled Better, which lays out a vision for both my professional and personal life. It ends with the earnest request to accept only excellence from myself. In December of that year, I wrote an entry titled The Plan, underneath which I put a list of my values in life, falling under the categories of relationships, virtues, and qualities. I still remember writing this entry on my bed in my fourth floor walk-up outside Harvard Square. I had just recently come back from sitting Shiva with a friend who had lost a parent, and getting a grip on what mattered to me suddenly seemed important. This entry also gets credit for instigating a habit where every time I started a new Moleskine notebook, I would begin by transcribing my current list of values underneath the heading The Plan in the notebook's first pages. The 2010 entries are particularly interesting, as they contain the seeds of the ideas that grew into my past three books, So Good They Can't Ignore You, Deep Work, and the title you're currently listening to. When I recently reread these notebooks, I was surprised to recall how far my thinking had already developed on issues like the danger of passion in career planning, the power of specialized craftsmanship in an age of general-purpose computing, and, presciently, the appeal of a new brand of technology-focused minimalism, which I was calling Simplicity 2.0 at the time. My first child was born in late 2012. Not surprisingly, the 2013 notebook is filled with reflections and urgent plans for figuring out how to be a father. My most recent notebook entries focus quite a bit on trying to clarify the years ahead now that I've succeeded in becoming a tenured professor and working author. I might be a couple of introspective notebooks away from figuring this out, but if personal history is a trusted guide, I'll get there. My Moleskine notebooks are not exactly diaries because I don't write in them on a regular schedule. If you flip through their pages, you'll encounter an uneven pacing. Sometimes I'll fill dozens of pages in a single week, while other times many months might pass without any new notes. The uneventful year of 2006, during which I was mainly just putting my head down and trying to stay ahead of my graduate coursework, has no entries at all. These notebooks play a different role. They provide me a way to write a letter to myself when encountering a complicated decision, or a hard emotion, or a surge of inspiration. By the time I'm done composing my thoughts in the structured form demanded by written prose, I've often gained clarity. I do make a habit of regularly reviewing these entries, but this habit is often superfluous. It's the act of writing itself that already yields the bulk of the benefits. Earlier in this chapter, I introduced Raymond Kethledge and Michael Irwin's definition of solitude as time spent alone with your own thoughts and free from inputs from other minds. Writing a letter to yourself is an excellent mechanism for generating exactly this type of solitude. It not only frees you from outside inputs, but also provides a conceptual scaffolding on which to sort and organize your thinking. Not surprisingly, I'm not the only person to discover this particular solitude hack. As Kethledge and Irwin report in their book, Dwight Eisenhower leveraged a practice of thinking by writing throughout his career to make sense of complicated decisions and tame intense emotions. He was not the only leader to deploy this habit. As mentioned earlier in this chapter, when visiting his cottage at the soldier's home, Abraham Lincoln had a habit of recording thoughts on scraps of paper that he would stick in his hat for safekeeping. Indeed, the first draft of Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation was collated, in part, from ideas spanning paper scraps. Inspired by this, the nonprofit that now operates the President Lincoln's Cottage Historical Site runs a program encouraging young students to do more rigorous original thinking. They call it Lincoln's Hat. This practice asks you to embrace this well-validated strategy by making time to write a letter to yourself when faced with demanding or uncertain circumstances. You can follow my lead and keep a special notebook for this purpose, or, like Abraham Lincoln, you can grab a scrap of paper when the need arises. The key is the act of writing itself. This behavior necessarily shifts you into a state of productive solitude, wrenching you away from the appealing digital baubles and addictive content waiting to distract you, and providing you with a structured way to make sense of whatever important things are happening in your life at the moment. It's a simple practice that's easy to deploy, but it's also incredibly effective. 5. Don't click like. The greatest duel in sports. In 2007, ESPN aired what has to be one of the strangest sporting events to ever appear on the channel, the National Championship of the USA Rock Paper Scissors League. The title match, which is preserved on YouTube, begins with the play-by-play announcers excitedly describing the two RPS phenoms, RPS being short for Rock Paper Scissors, that will be competing, declaring with deadpan seriousness that the audience is about to witness the greatest duel in sports. The competition is held in a mini boxing ring with a podium in the middle. The first contestant wears glasses and is dressed in khaki pants and a short sleeve button-down shirt. He trips on the ropes trying to climb into the ring. His nickname, we're told, is Land Shark. The second contestant, nicknamed The Brain, arrives, also dressed in khakis. He makes it into the ring without falling over. "That bodes well," the announcer helpfully explains. A referee enters and chops his hand over the podium to start the first match. Both players do a three count with their fists before throwing down their signs. The Brain chooses paper, while Land Shark chooses scissors. Point to Land Shark. The crowd cheers. A little less than 3 minutes later, with the score in his favor, Land Shark wins the championship and the $50,000 grand prize by smothering the Brain's rock with what the announcers call the paper heard around the world. On first encounter, the idea of serious rock-paper-scissors matches might sound silly. Unlike poker or chess, there doesn't seem to be any room for strategy, which, if true, would make the outcome of a given tournament essentially random. Except this is not what actually happens. During the peak of the league's popularity in the early 2000s, the same high-skilled players kept ending up near the top of tournament rankings, and when accomplished players compete against novices, the role of skill becomes even more pronounced. In a promotional video produced by the National League, a tournament-caliber player who goes by the name Master Rochambola, this moniker is a play on the French name Rochambeau, which is a slang term for rock, paper, scissors, challenges strangers to pickup games in a Las Vegas hotel lobby. He wins almost every time. The explanation for these results is that rock, paper, scissors, contrary to initial assumption, requires strategy. What separates advanced players like The Brain, Land Shark, and Master Rochambola from RPS mortals, however, is not a tediously memorized sequence of plays or statistical wizardry. It's instead their sophisticated grasp of a much broader topic, human psychology. A strong rock-paper-scissors player integrates a rich stream of information about their opponent's body language and recent plays to help approximate their opponent's mental state, and therefore make an educated guess about the next play. These players will also use subtle movements and phrases to prime their opponent to think about a certain play. The opponent, however, might notice the priming attempt and adjust their play accordingly. Of course, the original player might expect this and execute a tertiary adjustment, and so on. It should come as no surprise that participants in rock-paper-scissors tournaments often describe the experience as exhausting. To see some of these dynamics in action, let's return to the first throw of the 2007 championship match just described. Right before the players begin their three count, the Brain says, "Let's roll." This seems innocuous, but as the play-by-play announcer notes, this is a subliminal call for his opponent to play rock. The idea of rolling primes the mind to think about rocks. After planting this seed to nudge his opponent toward rock, the Brain plays paper. The subliminal strategy, however, backfires. Land Shark notices it and guesses what the Brain is up to, so he plays scissors, beating the Brain's paper and winning the throw. Understanding rock-paper-scissors champions is important to our purposes because their strategies highlight a foundational endowment shared by every human being on Earth, the ability to perform complicated social thinking. To put this ability to use for the narrow purpose of winning an RPS throw requires some game-specific practice, but as I'll elaborate, most people don't realize the extreme degree to which they perform similarly demanding feats of social navigation and mind reading throughout their normal everyday interactions. Our brains, in many ways, can be understood as sophisticated social computers. A natural conclusion of this reality is that we should treat with great care any new technology that threatens to disrupt the ways in which we connect and communicate with others. When you mess with something so central to the success of our species, it's easy to create problems. Coming up, I'll detail the ways in which our brains evolved to crave rich social interaction, and then explore the serious issues caused when we displace this interaction with highly appealing, but much less substantial, electronic pings. I'll then conclude by suggesting a somewhat radical strategy for the digital minimalist looking to sidestep these harms while maintaining the advantages of new communication tools, a strategy that puts these new forms of interaction to work supporting the old. The social animal. The idea that humans have a particular affinity for interaction and communication is not new. Aristotle famously noted that man is by nature a social animal. It wasn't, however, until surprisingly recently in the long sweep of human history that we discovered the biological extent to which this philosophical intuition turns out to be true. A key moment in this new understanding came in 1997, when a research team from Washington University published a pair of papers in the prestigious Journal of Cognitive Neuroscience. During this period, PET scanners, which were originally developed for medical purposes, were migrating into neuroscience research, where they provided researchers the breakthrough ability to observe brain activity. The Washington University team looked at a collection of these new brain imaging studies to investigate a simple question. Are there regions of the brain that are involved in all types of brain activity? As the psychologist Matthew Lieberman summarizes in his 2013 book, Social, the results of this initial analysis were disappointing, revealing that only a few regions showed increased activity across all the tasks, and they weren't very interesting brain regions. But the research team wasn't done. After failing to find regions that fired for many different activities, they decided to ask the opposite question. What, if anything, is active in the brain when someone is not trying to do a task? It was an unusual question, notes Lieberman, but we should be glad they asked, because it led to a remarkable discovery. The team found that there's a particular set of regions in the brain that consistently activate when you're not attempting to do a cognitive task, and that just as consistently deactivate once you focus your attention on something specific. Because almost any task caused this network to deactivate, the researchers originally called it the task-induced deactivation network. Because this name was a mouthful, it was eventually abbreviated to a catchier label, the default network. At first, scientists had no idea what the default network did. They had a long list of tasks that turned it off, telling them what it didn't do, but little hard evidence about its true purpose. Even without good evidence, however, scientists began to develop intuitions based on their own experience. One of these pioneering thinkers is our guide to this research, Matthew Lieberman, who now enters our narrative as an active participant. As Lieberman recalls, images of the default network were typically produced by asking a subject in a PET scanner to take a break from whatever repetitive activity the experiment required. Because the subject wasn't engaged in a specific task, it was easy for researchers to think of the default network as something that comes on when you're thinking about nothing. A little self-reflection, however, makes clear that our brains are hardly ever actually thinking about nothing. Even without a specific task, they tend to remain highly active, with thoughts and ideas flitting by in an ongoing noisy chatter. On further self-reflection, Lieberman realized that this background hum of activity tends to focus on a small number of targets, thoughts about other people, yourself, or both. The default network, in other words, seems to be connected to social cognition. Sure enough, once scientists knew what to look for, they discovered that the regions of the brain that defined the default network are virtually identical to the networks that light up during social cognition experiments. When given downtime, in other words, our brain defaults to thinking about our social life. It's here that Lieberman's research takes an interesting twist. When he first encountered the conclusion that the default network is social, he wasn't impressed. Like others in his field, he noted that people naturally have a strong interest in their own social life, so it's not surprising that this is what they like to think about when bored. As Lieberman continued to study different aspects of social cognition, however, his opinion shifted. "I have since become convinced that I had the relationship between these networks backward," he writes, "and this reversal is tremendously important." He now believes, "We are interested in the social world because we are built to turn on the default network during our free time. Put another way, our brains adapted to automatically practice social thinking during any moments of cognitive downtime, and it's this practice that helps us become really interested in our social world." Lieberman and his collaborators devised a clever series of experiments to confirm this hypothesis. In one study, for example, they found that the default network lights up during downtime even in newborns. The importance of finding this activity in infants is that they clearly haven't cultivated an interest in the social world yet. The infants studied cannot even focus their eyes. This behavior must therefore be instinctual. In another study, researchers put adult subjects in a scanner and asked them to solve math problems. They discovered that when they gave the subjects a 3-second break between problems, a duration too short for them to decide to start thinking about something else, the default network still fired up to fill the small gap, further indicating that this drive to think about social issues kicks in like a reflex. This finding underscores the fundamental importance of social connections to human well-being. As Lieberman summarizes, "The brain did not evolve over millions of years to spend its free time practicing something irrelevant to our lives." But the default network is not the whole story. Additional studies by Lieberman and his collaborators uncovered other examples where evolution placed big bets on the importance of sociality by adapting other expensive systems to serve its needs. The loss of social connection, for example, turns out to trigger the same system as physical pain, explaining why the death of a family member, a breakup, or even just a social snub can cause such distress. In one simple experiment, it was discovered that over-the-counter painkillers reduced social pain. Given the power of the pain system in driving our behavior, its connection to our social life underscores the importance of social relationships to our species' success. Lieberman also discovered that the human brain devotes significant resources to two different major networks that work together toward the goal of mentalizing, helping us understand other people's minds, including how they are feeling and their intentions. Something as simple as a casual conversation with a store clerk requires massive amounts of neuronal computational power to take in and process a high-bandwidth stream of clues about what's going on in the clerk's mind. Though this mind-reading feels natural to us, it's actually an amazingly complicated feat performed by networks honed over millions of years of evolution. It's exactly these highly adapted systems that are leveraged by the rock-paper-scissor champions who opened this chapter. These experiments represent only some key highlights among many from a vast social cognitive neuroscience literature that all point to the same conclusion. Humans are wired to be social. In other words, Aristotle was on the right track when he called us social animals, but it took the modern invention of advanced brain scanners to help us figure out how much he was likely understating this reality. This highly adapted human interest in social connection is a fascinating piece of our evolutionary history. It's also, however, a reality that should concern any digital minimalist. The intricate brain networks just described evolved over millions of years in environments where interactions were always rich, face-to-face encounters and social groups were small and tribal. The past two decades, by contrast, are characterized by the rapid spread of digital communication tools, my name for apps, services, or sites that enable people to interact through digital networks, which have pushed people's social networks to be much larger and much less local, while encouraging interactions through short, text-based messages and approval clicks that are orders of magnitude less information-laden than what we have evolved to expect. Perhaps predictably, this clash of old neural systems with modern innovations has caused problems, much in the same way that the innovation of highly processed foods in the mid-20th century led to a global health crisis. The unintended side effects of digital communication tools, a sort of social fast food, are proving to be similarly worrisome. The social media paradox. Determining the impact of digital communication tools on our psychological well-being is complicated. There's no shortage of scientific studies examining this topic, but different groups draw different conclusions from the same literature. Consider two contrasting takes on this topic that were both published around the same time in 2017. The first was an NPR story posted in March of that year, which summarized the results of a pair of big-deal new studies about the connection between social media use and well-being. Both studies found strong correlations between social media use and a range of negative factors, from perceived isolation to poorer physical health. The NPR story's title summarizes these findings well. Feeling lonely? Too much time on social media might be why. Not long after this NPR article came out, two members of Facebook's internal research team published a blog post defending their service against a rising tide of criticism that had begun in the aftermath of the contentious 2016 election. In this post, the authors acknowledge that some uses of social media might make people less happy, but then point to several research studies that establish that, when used properly, these services make subjects measurably happier. Using Facebook to keep in touch with friends and loved ones, the authors note, brings us joy and strengthens our sense of community. In other words, depending on whom you ask, social media is either making us lonely or bringing us joy. To better understand this general phenomenon of contrasting conclusions, let's look closer at the specific studies just summarized. One of the main positive articles cited by the Facebook blog post was authored by Moira Burke, a data scientist at the company, who also co-authored the blog post, and Robert Kraut, a human-computer interaction specialist at Carnegie Mellon University. It was published in the Journal of Computer-Mediated Communication in July 2016. In this study, Burke and Kraut recruited a group of around 1,900 Facebook users who agreed to quantify their current level of happiness when prompted. The researchers then used the Facebook server logs to connect specific social media activities with these well-being scores. They found that when users received targeted and composed information written by someone they know well, e.g., a comment sent by a family member, they felt better. On the other hand, receiving targeted and composed information from someone they didn't know well, or receiving a like, or reading a status update broadcast to many people, didn't correlate with improved well-being. Another positive article cited in the Facebook post was authored by social psychologists Fenn Dieters from the Freie Universität Berlin and Matthias Mell from the University of Arizona. It appeared in a journal called Social Psychology and Personality Science back in September 2013. In this study, Mell and Dieters deployed a controlled experiment. During a one-week period, some subjects were asked to make more Facebook posts than normal, while the others were given no instructions. The experimental group who were asked to post more ended up reporting less loneliness than the control group during this week. Closer questioning revealed this was due primarily to feeling more connected to their friends on a daily basis. These two studies seem to paint a compelling picture of social media boosting happiness and banishing loneliness. But let's now muddy the waters by considering the main two negative studies cited in the NPR article that came out during the same period as the Facebook post. The first of these studies was authored by a large team from diverse disciplines, led by Brian Primack from the University of Pittsburgh. It appeared in the prestigious American Journal of Preventive Medicine in July 2017. Primack and his team surveyed a nationally representative sample of adults between the ages of 19 and 22 using the same type of random sample techniques that pollsters deploy to measure public opinion during elections. The survey asked a standard set of questions that measure the subject's perceived social isolation, PSI, a loneliness metric. It also asked about usage of 11 different major social media platforms. After crunching the numbers, the researchers found that the more someone used social media, the more likely they were to be lonely. Indeed, someone in the highest quartile of social media use was 3 times more likely to be lonelier than someone in the lowest quartile. These results held up even after the researchers controlled for factors such as age, gender, relationship status, household income, and education. Primack admitted to NPR that he was surprised by the results. "It's social media, so aren't people supposed to be socially connected?" But the data was clear. The more time you spend connecting on these services, the more isolated you're likely to become. The other study cited in the NPR article was authored by Holly Shakya of the University of California, San Diego, and Nicholas Christakis of Yale, and it appeared in the American Journal of Epidemiology in February 2017. Shakya and Christakis used data from over 5,200 subjects from a nationally representative panel survey, combined with observed Facebook behavior of the subjects. They studied associations between Facebook activity and self-reported measures of physical health, mental health, and life satisfaction, among other quality of life metrics. As they report, "Our results show that overall, the use of Facebook was negatively associated with well-being. They found, for example, that if you increase the amount of likes or links clicked by a standard deviation, mental health decreases by 5 to 8% of a standard deviation. These negative connections still held when, like in the Primack study, they controlled for relevant demographic variables." These dueling studies seem to present a paradox. Social media makes you feel both connected and lonely, happy and sad. To resolve this paradox, let's start by looking closer at the experimental designs just described. The studies that found positive results focused on specific behaviors of social media users, while the studies that found negative results focused on overall use of these services. The natural assumption is that these variables would be positively connected. If common social media behaviors increase well-being, then the more you use these services, the more of these mood-boosting behaviors you'll engage in, and the happier you should be. Therefore, after reading the positive studies, you would expect that increasing social media use would increase well-being. But this, of course, was the opposite of what the researchers discovered in the negative studies. There must, therefore, be another factor at play, something that increases the more you use social media, generating negative impacts that swamp out the smaller positive boosts. Fortunately for our investigation, Holly Shakya identified a likely suspect for this factor. The more you use social media to interact with your network, the less time you devote to offline communication. "What we know at this point," Shakya told NPR, "is that we have evidence that replacing your real-world relationships with social media use is detrimental to your well-being." To help explore this idea, Shakya and Christakis also measured offline interactions and found they were associated with positive effects, a finding that has been widely replicated in the social psychology literature. As they then noted, the negative associations of Facebook use are comparable in magnitude to the positive impact of offline interaction, suggesting a trade-off. The problem, then, is not that using social media directly makes us unhappy. Indeed, as the positive studies just cited found, certain social media activities, when isolated in an experiment, modestly boost well-being. The key issue is that using social media tends to take people away from the real-world socializing that's massively more valuable. As the negative studies imply, the more you use social media, the less time you tend to devote to offline interaction, and therefore, the worse this value deficit becomes, leaving the heaviest social media users much more likely to be lonely and miserable. The small boosts you receive from posting on a friend's wall or liking their latest Instagram photo can't come close to compensating for the large loss experienced by no longer spending real-world time with that same friend. As Shakya summarizes, where we want to be cautious is when the sound of a voice or a cup of coffee with a friend is replaced with likes on a post. The idea that real-world interactions are more valuable than online interactions isn't surprising. Our brains evolved during a period when the only communication was offline and face-to-face. As argued earlier in the chapter, these offline interactions are incredibly rich because they require our brains to process large amounts of information about subtle analog cues such as body language, facial expressions, and voice tone. The low bandwidth chatter supported by many digital communication tools might offer a simulacrum of this connection, but it leaves most of our high-performance social processing networks underused, reducing these tools' ability to satisfy our intense sociality. This is why the value generated by a Facebook comment or Instagram like, although real, is minor compared to the value generated by an analog conversation or shared real-world activity. We don't have good data on why people trade online for offline communication when given access to digital communication tools, but it's easy to generate convincing hypotheses based on common experience. An obvious culprit is that online interaction is both easier and faster than old-fashioned conversation. Humans are naturally biased toward activities that require less energy in the short term, even if it's more harmful in the long term. So we end up texting our sibling instead of calling them on the phone, or liking a picture of a friend's new baby instead of stopping by to visit. A subtler effect is the way that digital communication tools can subvert the offline communication that remains in your life. Because our primal instinct to connect is so strong, it's difficult to resist checking a device in the middle of a conversation with a friend or bath time with a child, reducing the quality of the richer interaction right in front of us. Our analog brain cannot easily distinguish between the importance of the person in the room with us and the person who just sent us a new text. Finally, as detailed in the first part of this book, many of these tools are engineered to hijack our social instincts to create an addictive allure. When you spend multiple hours a day compulsively clicking and swiping, there's much less free time left for slower interactions. And because this compulsive use emits a patina of socialness, it can delude you into thinking that you're already serving your relationships well, making further action unnecessary. To state the obvious, this account doesn't cover all the possible dangers of digital communication tools. Critics have also highlighted the ability for social media to make us feel ostracized or inadequate, as well as to stoke exhausting outrage, inflame our worst tribal instincts, and perhaps even degrade the democratic process itself. For the remainder of this chapter, however, I want to bypass a discussion of the potential pathologies of the social media universe and keep our focus on the zero-sum relationship between online and offline interaction. I believe this to be the most fundamental of the issues caused by the digital communication era, and the key trap that a minimalist must understand in trying to successfully navigate the pluses and minuses of these new tools. Reclaiming conversation. Up to this point in the chapter, we've relied on some clunky terminology to differentiate interaction mediated through text interfaces and mobile screens from the old-fashioned analog communication our species evolved to crave. Going forward, I want to borrow some useful phrasing from MIT professor Sherry Turkle, a leading researcher on the subjective experience of technology. In her 2015 book, Reclaiming Conversation, Turkle draws a distinction between connection, her word for the low-bandwidth interactions that define our online social lives, and conversation, the much richer, high-bandwidth communication that defines real-world encounters between humans. Turkle agrees with our premise that conversation is crucial. Face-to-face conversation is the most human and humanizing thing we do. Fully present to one another, we learn to listen. It's where we develop the capacity for empathy. It's where we